Good evening and welcome to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule. And tonight my guests are writers from the anthology Brought to Light, More Stories of Forgotten Women. Now we have had various groupings of the writers all through the fall from this book, and this is our last evening of writers from that amazing book, and I say so knowing that I edited it. But it's a really powerful group of stories of women whose stories are not very often told. And tonight my guests are Carolee Way King, Ellen S. Jaffe, and Jean Ryan, who is stepping in for Barbara Ribello, who is a little under the weather tonight. So we'll be calling Jean Barbara tonight. She's going to fill in. All right. So the book came together because, well, it's a sequel to the book In the Wings. So the stories are quite compelling, and I'll just take them one at a time, I think, and just mention who's in the book. So there's Francesca and Maria, the mother and wet nurse of Michelangelo. There's Metio Tasca, the mother of Tecumseh. Sophia Pooley, who was a slave of Joseph Brandt's. There's Maria Waite, who was a wife of 1838 rebel Benjamin Waite. Nora Sidgwick, a mathematician and co-founder of the Society for Psychical Research. Wilhelmina Geddes, an Irish stained glass artist. Lillian Matthews Burden, the last Mi'kmaq shaman of Newfoundland. Caroline Armington, a Canadian dry point artist. Mona Parsons, an anti-Nazi activist in Holland. Leonie Farrell, a polio vaccine scientist. Amrita Sher-Gill, an Indian painter. Viola Desmond, who was a Canadian civil rights activist. Aileen Mosby, a journalist, an amazingly interesting journalist that nobody's heard of from the mid-20th century. Brenda Davies, actor and wife of Robertson Davies. And Martha Nelson Thomas, soft sculpture artist whose work was the stolen template for the Cabbage Patch dolls. Those are the people that you're not going to hear from tonight, or hear about tonight. But now here are who you are going to hear from. Carolee Way King wrote about Catherine Coffin, an abolitionist and Underground Railroad activist. And Barbara Ribello wrote about Elizabeth Warner Chrysler, a widow of the Ancaster Bloody Assizes. And Ellen S. Jaffe wrote about Rosalind Franklin, pioneer of DNA research. So you can see that you're in for some fascinating stories tonight. We're going to begin with Carolee Way King because we're doing the stories in chronological order, which is how they appear in the book. Carolee Way King has been writing and telling stories since childhood. Many of her stories, written for oral performance, are about real women who chose to lead lives which are out of the ordinary. A lifelong interest in the Underground Railroad and her own Quaker faith led her to Catherine Coffin. So, Carolee Way King, welcome to Art Waves.
Thank you very much, Bernadette. It's lovely to be here again.
I'm delighted that you could be here tonight. We had a reading at Different Drummer this afternoon, so it was fun to kind of pull everybody together and continue the celebration tonight on Art Waves. So you want to tell me how Catherine Coffin came to your notice?
Well, as a child, I was fascinated by the Underground Railroad and all the amazingly courageous people who traveled on it and those people who helped to make it work. And it is inevitable, if you are looking at the Underground Railroad, to encounter Levi Coffin, who was often called president of the Underground Railroad. He worked first in Indiana and later in Ohio. And he was a very strong abolitionist from a very early age. He married Catherine Coffin. Well, he married Catherine, who became Coffin. And she was his partner in all things. She and he designed their house with parts of it available to hide slaves. They had a hollow wall that 14 people could hide in standing up.
Oh my goodness.
They had a place upstairs where the bedroom had the slanted wall under the eave came to the top of the bed. And if you moved the bed, there was a doorway into the eaves. And a person or several people could be thoroughly hidden in there. And Catherine was as brave and as bold and courageous about this as her husband. She was the one who nurtured and cared for the slaves when they were inside the coffin's home. And Levi was the one who did the machinations outside the home, getting the false bottom wagon ready and so on. Catherine often disguised people in order to have them travel more safely. And she nursed various people who had encountered such difficulties that gave them injuries or illness, nursed them back to health. She had a sewing circle that made clothing for the various freedom seekers and packed them food to take along the way, gave them courage. They started out with plenty of courage, but often by the time they got to the coffins, it was beginning to flag, and she would help to restore that. These people, none of them was uncourageous. They were all amazing people who had the guts to get away from an unfair system. And Catherine was just one of many helpers, but she was important, and she is largely forgotten.
Yes, and her husband is remembered, as usual, right?
Yes.
But she's forgotten no more, because you have written a beautiful story. I have to tell you, Carol Lee Waking, that while I was reading your story, my heart was just in my mouth. You really did a good job of bringing to life the terror of the work that Catherine and Levi Coffin did, and the terrible trauma for the people who were asylum seeking. Where did you say that her home was? It was just on the other side of the Ohio?
It was just barely in Indiana. It's near a town called Richmond. Okay. Indiana, that most people do know. Newport is the town now, but it used to be called Fountain City.
Fountain City, Indiana.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, it was a large Quaker community, so a lot of people in the community did know that there were slaves coming in and out, or okay. ex-slaves coming in and out.
And you say you visited the place, you saw it.
I did. It was very exciting to be there, mm-hmm. to see the hiding places, to see the wagon that has a false bottom that people could hide in and then
the
goods put over them. And even if bayonets were stabbed into the goods, it couldn't reach the people. They were safe.
Gosh, it is truly amazing what people went through. And
it
I say on their way to Canada, some just went to the northern U.S.
Some went to the northern U.S., but most of the ones who came through the coffin home made it to Canada.
Okay.
Had Canada as their goal and made it there, and none was ever caught and returned.
Wow. Oh, that's so good to hear.
It is. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's good to hear some heartening stories from that terrible time. Okay, well, are you willing to read us a passage from your story?
I am willing to read a passage from the story. I'm going to begin with a story that a lot of people have heard because it was immortalized in the book Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Okay.
A very exciting story was a real person. This really happened to her. And she did end up at the coffin's house, and the coffins did look after her and get her safely to Canada. So when my story begins, Eliza is living with Catherine and Levi, recovering from her ordeal. Only 1 week earlier, Eliza had been a slave on the Davis plantation in Kentucky. She was the mother of but one surviving child, who was all the more precious for that. She had been prized as a slave for her beauty and her light skin, for both her mother and her father had been sired by masters on slave women. Her light complexion also made her desirable as a commodity. She decided on her own to make an attempt at escape after she had discovered that Davis, who had suffered some pecuniary vexations, was about to sell her south, away from her family, doubtless for a very favorable price. Knowing that either way she could lose both husband and child, she took the young boy with her in the hope that he might grow up free from the bonds that turned herself and all her people into chattels. That, or die in the attempt. In the deepest hour of night, when darkness was like a velvet cloak over the plantation and all were asleep in both the big house and the slaves' quarters, she had lifted her sleeping two-year-old into her arms, wrapped a long shawl about him to bind him against her, and with a last brief, fond look at her sleeping husband, slipped from the cabin like a shadow. All night she walked until she could walk no more, rested, and walked again until at dawn she at last reached the Ohio River, 10 miles north of the plantation, where she planned to cross to the free state of Ohio. To her despair, she found that the river was not the solid ice she expected, but rather had begun to break up and was flowing slowly in sluggish chunks, not a safe passage at all, but a perilous obstacle course. Exhausted with exertion, terror, and disappointment, she had been taken in by a white family who lived in a cabin on the riverbank. These people gave her food, warmed her, and let her rest through the day. Eliza knew that her disappearance from the Davis place would be discovered that morning, and that she was not safe resting here. The slave catchers would be on her trail, and since this was the most direct path to the river, they were not likely to be long in coming. Indeed, at dusk, she was barely waking from sleep when she was sure that she heard hoofbeats in the distance. Alert in an instant, she sat up and listened carefully. There was no mistake. Horses were approaching at an alarming speed. She gathered the sleeping child into her arms and darted out the back door of the cabin, and at that very moment she heard the horses being reined in at the front. Down the sloping bank she scrambled, but the horsemen had caught sight of her. With the three men crashing through the brush only a few yards behind her, she hesitated not a moment at the edge of the dark, icy water flowing past. She used the momentum she had from rushing down the slope to make a desperate leap onto an ice floe. It tipped crazily under her weight, but she stepped to its other edge and jumped to the next floe without an instant's delay. It dipped and began to turn, but she went on to the next and the next. In her rush to outrun the slave catchers, she had left the cabin without her boots, and her feet were soon cut and bleeding. Each floe was marked with red as she jumped onto it and leapt off again. Her pursuers stood in consternation on the southern bank, believing she would surely fall in and drown or freeze. Fascinated, they watched her progress. Halfway across the river, one of the floes tipped more wildly under her weight than the others and dipped below the water, sliding her into the black iciness. Somehow she tossed the boy onto the floe as she went into the water, and then clawing, scrabbling, she pulled herself onto it, picked up the child, and jumped to the next floe, and the next, until at last, as if by force of will or grace of God, but not by any seeming likelihood or probability, she reached the far shore. There, out of the darkness, a hand reached down to her and pulled her onto the bank in safety. "Any woman who crossed that river carrying her baby has won her freedom," said the voice of Chance Shaw. "Every person deserves freedom," Catherine had said when she heard this part of the story. The slave catchers on the Kentucky shore were dumbfounded by her escape, but none of the men looked at the prospect of pursuing her across the river on the flowing crush of broken ice as worth the risk. Chance Shaw helped her to find the house of John and Jean Rankin, where she was warmed and given food. The Rankins, however, felt as Eliza did that it was still too dangerous for Eliza and the baby to stay there in Ripley, and so once she and the child were in dry clothing and had eaten, they were hurried on to another safe house farther from the river. The next night, they were taken from station to station, as the safe houses were called, until they reached Newport and the relative safety of the coffin's home. At least in Indiana, it was not legal to search a home without a warrant, which for abolitionists usually meant that a fugitive would have time to be hidden properly before anyone could enter the home. Eliza and her little son were recovering their strength under Catherine's tender ministrations. Nutritious food, proper clothing, and sound sleep, and most important, a sense of safety, which Catherine's calm produced, had brought them both to a place of far greater physical and spiritual well-being than they had known since Eliza had discovered her master's plans to sell her. Her feet, however, though bathed and bandaged carefully each day by Catherine herself, were healing more slowly. The bruises were diminishing and the cuts closing, but it was still unclear whether all her toes would recover from the frostbite. She padded gingerly about the house on her thick bandages. Catherine had no intention of letting Eliza travel onward until her feet could be safely laced into the boots the Rankins had provided for her.
Oh, my goodness. Carolee Way King reading from The Criminal Life of Catherine Coffin. Thank you so much, Carolee. Beautifully read and beautifully written.
Thank you.
Yeah, just it's amazing to me how creative nonfiction can bring these stories to life and take us right there and make us, because you hear of the Underground Railroad all the time, but this is very powerfully rendered, I think.
Thank you very much, Bernadette. It's very exciting to get into the life of a character you've admired and try to see what that person had experienced.
Yeah, yeah. Well done. Thank you, Carolee Way King.
Thank you.
Our next reader is Barbara Ribello. Barbara Ribello studied in McMaster's Creative Writing Program. She's been published in Main Street, In the Dark, Stories from the Supernatural from Tightrope Books, and Engraved, also from Seraphim. Her first novel, The Ghost of Y Villa, is a mystery set among her ancestral roots in Somerset, England. Barbara Ribello lives in Flamborough, where she is writing a sequel to that novel. So, welcome to ArtWaves, Barbara Ribello.
For those of you who missed the introduction, Barbara Ribello, unfortunately, is under the weather tonight. My name is Jean Ryan, and I am delighted to have the opportunity to read from Barb's work.
Tell us a little bit about it as you understand it, Jean.
Well, in the author's note, Barb says that it's a work of creative nonfiction set amid the turmoil of the War of 1812. Elizabeth Warner and her husband, Adam Chrysler, were Barbara's great-grandparents of six generations previous. She discovered Adam Chrysler's fate when she was a teenager, helping her Chrysler cousin do ancestral research in Norfolk County. And then while attending writing classes at McMaster, she met Sandra Lloyd, whose grandfather, 16 generations previous, was Peter Warner, Elizabeth's brother. Now, as a further aside, Sandra Lloyd is also a friend of mine and in my writing group. So circles both, within circles.
And both writers.
That's right. Yeah. And both very much interested in their United Empire Loyalist roots. Mm-hmm. Barb then says she went through extensive reading, studies of timelines, and information generously shared by Sandra Lloyd, and she has attempted to reconstruct Elizabeth Warner's story in her own voice.
Mm-hmm. And what she said this afternoon, Barbara said this afternoon, was that she wanted to show all that the pioneer women suffered in coming and how hard they had to work to build a life here in the first place. And then, you know, having child after child, she also married a man that her father did not approve of. Her father never liked Adam Chrysler and didn't want her to marry him. And they were all from the States, having fled the... Well, being United Empire Loyalists, having fled the revolution in the States. And so Adam Chrysler always felt quite bitter because of the treatment that his father received. He was hanged. And he thinks that's part of his inability to completely accept the idea of rule by England. So he kind of started to work with the enemy, as it were, during the War of 1812 and became one of those who was hanged. This was horrible for Elizabeth, and Barbara said she also wanted to show what she lost, which was everything. She lost her home, her freedom, her reputation, some of her children, and her husband, of course. So that is the story that Jean Ryan is going to read from tonight, and it's entitled The 28 Days. So, Jean, do you want to set up the reading that you're going to do for us?
Well, you just covered half of it.
Okay.
But what I'd like to do, because I'm intrigued by pieces in it, is just read some bits and pieces from throughout the story as opposed to one paragraph.
Sure.
So, as you mentioned, Bernadette, Elizabeth Warner's father did not approve of Adam Chrysler. Elizabeth Warner was 15 years old when she first met him. Adam Chrysler was 23. And as Barb writes, feeling Adam's eyes rest on me, I stole a glance at him from beneath my bonnet. He was of medium height with a husky build, thick dark hair and a face browned by the sun. But it was his gaze upon me that stirred my heart. Sorrowful hazel eyes that warmed in admiration, then suddenly hardened like flint and looked away when his uncle spoke to him. Father observed this. He saw all. he finished his business, and on the way home, he admonished me for giving young Adam my attention. For some time, he'd had a much older man in mind for my hand, but I had no interest in becoming the wife of a widowed farmer with three children. I said as such, and it was then that my father told me that young Adam's father, Baltus, had been executed under murky circumstances early in the Revolutionary War, and that while his uncles were respectable loyalists, I was to have nothing to do with him. Well, needless to say, Elizabeth was a bit rebellious, and she had seen Adam, and he had stolen her heart. Her father finally relented on the condition that Adam and Elizabeth attend our meeting house on Sundays, where their wedding bands were read. They were married before her 16th birthday. They had nothing of their own, lived and worked with and for Adam's uncles. Later on, her father was granted 182 acres of land in the township of Walpole, near Nanticoke by Lake Erie. The land needed to be farmed, and father came to them suggesting that they clear a section, build their cabin, and begin sharecropping. Elizabeth's spirits lifted at this opportunity, but when she hugged Adam, he stiffened in her arms. She had not anticipated his wounded pride and bitterness. He stalked away from us. She wanted to follow him, but thought it best to let him consider the offer alone. She turned to her father and tried to explain. We could give our answer when we were ready. So Adam Chrysler finally agreed, and with reluctance, she asked him for 5 years so that they would all be able to receive their own property in the meantime, and they could put away a bit of money for their share of the crops. It was early summer 1812 when father rode up our lane with news from the British post at Fort George, Niagara. American armies threatened the border strongholds, including Queenston, right by our doorstep. War was declared between the United States and Upper Canada. Adam and I were raising our children and crops and cared little for political issues. We were no different than our loyalist settler friends who had been lured by the promise of cheap land. Neighboring farmers arrived at our cabin, echoing our sentiments in vigorous talk with Adam in the barnyard. This war was a nuisance, an interruption of our lives, and a threat to our autumn harvests. Indoors, while quilting, my women friends and I overheard our husbands' hints of uncertain loyalties and that they did not want to fight. During the summer of 1812, militias were hastily summoning citizens and farmers. Father's old regiment, Butler's Rangers, was raised and renamed Lincoln Militia. Uncle Adam and William rode over one evening and advised Adam to join up before he was conscripted. He reluctantly did so. They were drilled 3 times a month and called upon as needed. Adam and others were placed on the flanks and, after engagements and skirmishes, were sent home to tend crops. The autumn ripened into scarlet and gold, pungent with the aroma of threshold hay. It was the last decent crop we had, brought in with the help of 2 men Adam knew, Isaac Petten and John Johnston. As 1813 began, Adam was away from home more and more. With only 15-year-old Elizabeth and 11-year-old Baltus and myself to work the fields by that autumn harvest, we lost what little we had. The animals were starving, and there was little milk for the children. Adam would go hunting with the local men and come home with rabbits and deer meat. Young Baltus begged to go and learn to hunt, and Adam agreed, as if he sensed we would have to depend on Baltus in the near future. It was at this time I felt my husband begin to reject me. He had become almost a stranger to us, his manner even more cold and distant. When I asked him what was amiss, he told me he was trying to find food or money. By October, his talk distressed me. Dark suspicions were circulating. He and Baltus came into the cabin one day and told me they'd hung the deer meat to dry. He went about stuffing some bread into his rucksack. Without explanation or a goodbye, he left. And because he'd been so miserable and distant, I was relieved he'd taken the tension with him. He didn't come home until the dawn of the 13th that month, when I awoke to see him standing at the foot of our bed, without his coat, a thin and ragged scarecrow, eyes sunken, his hair and beard matted. He took up a blanket and his rifle and went to the barn for the night, with no account for his absence, other than to say if anyone came looking for him, I hadn't seen him. He didn't pause to notice my tears of anguish. Where had he been? What had he done? My fears were well-founded, for the next day a knock came at the door. Two women in heavy cloaks slipped inside. One grasped my hands and sat me down. The other sent the children into the next room and drew the curtains. In low voices, they told me that the previous night, the Nanticoke militia had raided and arrested one of their husbands and 14 other men at John Dunham's cabin near Nanticoke, and a couple of men had escaped. Where was Adam? When the women left, they uttered, "May God help your man."
Oh, my God. Thank you, Jean Ryan, for reading from Barbara Bellow's story, The 28 Days. It's a very sad story, isn't it? It's just relentlessly painful. And what's interesting to me is how Barbara was able to imagine her grandparents in the intimacy of their marriage, as it's, you know, the stresses and strains on that, and it beginning to come apart and them becoming estranged.
It personalizes something that we may have heard about in history. Mm-hmm. And I, for one, find that type of thing incredibly compelling and emotional.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're real people. There are faces to them now. There are names to them now.
That's right. You know, I never drive through Ancaster past the old mill without thinking about the Bloody Assizes. And that is where it all happened, although the mill was a slightly older mill. That the original mill that they were all kept imprisoned in was, or wherever, the hotel that they were kept imprisoned in, all of those buildings were burned eventually, and those are new ones, but not much newer than that time period. So, yeah, Ancaster is full of this specific history, and this was the last public hanging in Canada, these men at the Ancaster Bloody Assizes. It happened on York Boulevard, just about where that Tim Hortons used to be, that's now something else. That's right about where it happened. It's crazy to think. And they were sentenced to be drawn and quartered and horrific things, but the Crown had, quote-unquote, mercy on them and just hanged them by the neck until they were dead. So, very sad story. Very effectively written by Barbara Ribello. And thank you, Jean, for standing in for her tonight.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Was there anything else you wanted to say about
it? Well, there's a little bit here as part of her epilogue, if I have a few more minutes.
You do.
The day following Adam's trial and death verdict, despite a tremendous emotional toll, Elizabeth Warner came forward and testified on behalf of John Johnston and young Isaac Pettit before Justice Scott. It was suggested from evidence that Pettit had taken some part with the marauders, but he had refused to accompany them and had been branded as a coward. He was found guilty, but later sent to Kingston Jail, where he died March 16, 1815, of jail fever. Johnston was also saved from hanging and was sent to Kingston Jail. He survived and received a pardon on the condition of abandoning the province and all other British possessions for life. He was sent to the United States. Of the 15 men sentenced to death, 8 were hanged and the rest sent to Kingston Jail. While the executions were not as horrific as the judge ordered, they were terrible enough. A 12-year-old boy witnessed the hangings and described the scene to a Hamilton newspaper. Once the nooses were adjusted, the wagons are driven off, leaving the prisoners to strangle. Their contortions are such that a heavy brace comes loose and falls, striking one of the dying men on the head and mercifully putting an end to his struggles. Later, all 8 heads are chopped off and publicly exhibited.
Golly, George. Oh, boy. Well,
it's hard to believe.
It is. It is hard to believe because, 1814 is not that far back.
No.
Pretty sickening. Thank you so much, Jean Ryan, reading for Barbara Bellow from her story that is in Brought to Light, More Stories of Forgotten Women, published by Seraphim Editions, which is the book that we're reading from tonight on Art Waves. And I'm Bernadette Rule. And again, my guests are Carol Lee Way King, Jean Ryan standing in for Barbara Ribello, and Ellen S. Jaffe. Ellen S. Jaffe lives in Hamilton, Ontario. Guernica published her second poetry collection, Skinny Dipping with the Muse, in 2014. She has won several literary awards, received grants from the Ontario Arts Council, and she teaches creative writing. Ellen S. Jaffe appreciates this opportunity to get to know the Rosalind Franklin story and tell it. So, Rosalind Franklin, why did you want to tell her story?
Well, Rosalind Franklin is a much more modern person. She was born in 1920, and she died in 1958, so she was only 38 when she died. She was a scientist, a British scientist, and she did work on the DNA molecule and the structure of DNA. She was a crystal photographer, which meant she took x-rays of crystals. At that time, scientific technology wasn't as advanced as it is now, and they didn't have, say, electron microscopes and other things. But she was very proficient in her field, and she was well on the way to discovering the structure of DNA, and she had these photographs, and there was a particular one, number 51. And then, sort of unbeknownst to her, one of her colleagues, with whom she was not getting along very well, took her work and gave it to Watson and Crick, who were working at Cambridge. That was John Watson and Francis Crick, who then went on to make that leap where they discovered that DNA was a double helix. This is all, you know, quite scientific. And poor Rosalind Franklin, she went on to other work. She left the lab that she was in and went on to other work she really enjoyed, but then she developed ovarian cancer early in 56 and died in 1958. So she was never given credit, even when Watson and Crick won the Nobel Prize in the early 60s. They didn't give her credit, and she wouldn't have, the Nobel Prize can't be awarded posthumously anyway. So at some point in the last, I would say, decade or so, I discovered her story, and I was just interested in a woman who was Jewish and a scientist, and I wanted to know more about her life. I'm a writer, but my father was a doctor, and I've always had an interest in science. So I wanted to find out more about her, and then when this opportunity came, I actually delved into it more deeply. And I found that actually she's being brought to light more. You know, this is not the first time anyone's written about her. There's a wonderful biography by Brenda Maddox called Rosalind Franklin, Dark Lady of DNA, which is what one of her colleagues, Maurice Wilkins, had called her. And there's a biography by her sister, Jennifer Glynn, which just came out in 2012, My Sister Rosalind Franklin. And a lot of research, especially in England, honoring her at this point. But I still wanted to find out who she was as a person, mm-hmm. and Maddox's biography was very good about that, too. I found out she loved mountain climbing, and she had from an early age, and she was actually quite beautiful, but some people thought her very arrogant. And in Watson's book, his early book about the double helix, which was written for a lay audience, he just maligns her. He's just so rude and condescending. And then at the end, he says, oh, but really, I don't really believe that. She really was a very good scientist. And, why did you write the whole book about her? Yeah. A little late. So I felt quite sad. That I think she would have gone on if she'd lived. And clearly her sister, who is her younger sister, but her sister is over 80 at this point. So, you know, if she'd lived, she probably would have gone on to do really wonderful things in science and probably in her life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very sad. And you said she contracted cancer.
It was ovarian cancer, which is actually her family, it's called Ashkenazi. It's the Jews from Eastern Europe. And Ashkenazi Jewish women are particularly prone to developing ovarian cancer. Mm. And her family had come to England in the 1700s, so they didn't directly live through the Holocaust, but they took in refugees, similar to, you know, the Underground Railroad. And so she was very aware, and she had a streak, a very humanitarian streak in her as well. She wanted to help people.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Okay, so you really enjoyed getting to know Rosalind Franklin.
I did.
And you called your story another twist of the double helix.
Yes, well, the double helix is the shape of the DNA. This is sort of another twist in the story. And
I thought that was a very clever title.
And part of my challenge in writing was to make it an interesting story.
Yeah.
And also get the science right. And I did have a friend who helped me with the science.
And who helped you with that?
I have a friend, Roger Gilbert, who is knows a lot about science and is also a good writer. So he was able to read the story a few times and just put me in the right direction. Yeah,
right,
put me in the right direction. And I said Brent and Maddox was very good on that as well. And so I hope I've done justice to that. And I decided to, you know, there are many points at which you can enter somebody's life. And I decided to set the story just on one day when she's in the hospital, very near the end of her life. It could be the day before she dies. And I found out she had died in April of 1958. And you can actually look up on Google and find out what the weather was like that day.
Oh,
amazing.
Yeah.
So it was a warm day. So I had her, you know, involved with looking at the flowers and hearing the birds.
Mm-hmm. So she died in hospital.
She died in the hospital, and she was actually overlooking her flat, the flat that she had in London, the Royal Marsden Hospital.
Okay. All right, so you're going to read us a passage?
So I'll read a passage.
Okay, and this is Ellen S. Jaffe reading from her story in Brought to Light, Another Twist of the Double Helix, which is about the scientist Rosalind Franklin. Did you need to set the story up
Well,
for us?
Well, set up, actually, I was maybe read two different passages. According to the research I've done, she was never completely clear in her life what had happened to the, you know, that they had actually taken this. It was never proven. You know, and she died before she really knew, but she had her suspicions. Yeah. So I'll read a bit of that section. So she's in the hospital. She's awake enough to think about her life, and she's really trying to review her life and the whole, you know, what she's done in her science and her life.
Okay.
So, and this colleague, as I mentioned, Wilkins, he's the one who had called her the Dark Lady. Wilkins had called her the Dark Lady of DNA, and she knew that Watson and some of the others called her Rosie behind her back. Rosie, indeed. Don had called her Roz, but that was different. They were friends. Interesting, she thought, that the closest male friends she'd had were Jewish, even though they didn't know it when they first met. She'd worked hard on the X-ray photographs of crystallized DNA, both the A and B forms, trying to find the key, trying to do her best in a lab where she never felt at home. Her student, Gosling, had been a great help. And she was the one who had first seen that the sugar phosphate molecule had to be on the outside of the DNA structure, not the inside. And then Crick and Watson, working at the Cavendish Lab in Cambridge, had taken the crucial next steps, intuiting the structure of the double helix, like the railings of a spiral staircase, with matching base pairs lined up between them. It was a great achievement, but it was almost as if they had seen her photographs, especially that beautiful number 51 of B DNA, and developed their model from that. How could that have happened? She'd once thought someone was reading her notebooks, and the photographs were available in the lab. Gosling could have shown them to Wilkins. And could Wilkins have shown them to Watson on one of his visits to London? Maybe that day that Watson had popped into her office unexpectedly, upsetting her with his barrage of words. There had been such competition back then, when they were all working toward the same goal, searching for something close to truth. That was several years ago, but the memory still hurt. She fell into a spasm of painful coughing. So I'm going to move on from there, just the way she actually did move on, and she went to another lab and started working with tobacco. It was called tobacco mosaic virus, and then the polio virus. And then she got sick when she was actually on a trip to the States. She was lecturing in California and then went on a trip to the Rocky Mountains with that friend Don, whom I mentioned. She'd also worked in Paris right after World War II. She worked on coal, taking photographs of coal and finding the structure of the coal. She did really, you know, quite important work. So I'm now going to read a little bit from the end of the book. While she was in Paris, she'd worked with a man named Mering. And Mering may have been someone she was in love with. She never married, and she never had children, and she thinks about that during the course of this story. But there was some kind of intensity between her and Mering. And Mering has come to visit her briefly, and she notices he has tears in his eyes. And now he's gone, but she could still feel Mering's touch on her face. Had he really been there to see her just a few moments ago? Had she been in love with him in Paris, or with anyone? Perhaps Don? She would have liked a relationship like the one Emily had with Voltaire, studying and working together, building a house in the country for scientific research and pleasure, with visitors coming and going. Just as Emily worked into the night by candlelight to finish her translation before she could die in childbirth, Rosalind reached again for her notebook and pencil on the table by the bed. She started to jot down some notes, but then her writing wavered and the pencil dropped from her fingers onto the blanket. She fell back onto the pillow. Still, she went on thinking, visualizing new experiments, new lines of research, feeling her mind at play. This was when she felt most herself. She had the odd thought flash that her ideas were her children, the only children she would ever have. She did not want to desert them now. Besides, they would not desert her. They rushed in helter-skelter at first, then more orderly, like a parade. No, more like mountain climbers, using ropes and climbing equipment to scale a rough, craggy face, finding a new path, exploring uncharted territory, excited and yet careful. She was sorry they were about to be orphaned. Okay, so this is how she's feeling about her thoughts there. And my feeling was that she did feel very personal. And then she's now, as one does when one's dying, she looks out the window. Through the window, Rosalind could hear robins and sparrows and smell the soft air. She closed her eyes again. When she opened them, she saw she was not alone. Her younger sister Jennifer was there, holding her hand. She felt a cool cloth on her forehead, her wrists inside her elbows. Jennifer had brought bright yellow and pink tulips to cheer her up. The colors warmed her, but they also hurt her heart. She wouldn't go out into the garden again where the tulips were blooming in the earth in great arrays. Unlike them, these tulips in their vase would fade quickly, droop, and die. This touch of color made her see how white the room was. The tulips opened like hungry mouths, baby birds demanding food or stars in the sky. What strange thoughts. If she was a poet, like that American woman Sylvia she'd met at a reception at Newnham College a few years ago, she could try to write about this feeling. But her writing has always taken another direction. She would write about the patterns of the tulips, the genetics that determined their shapes and colors. Okay, I'll stop there.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ellen Jaffe, for bringing Rosalind Franklin to life.
Thank you. I wanted to mention the couple of people. When I mentioned Emily in Voltaire, that's a real person. Voltaire had a mistress named Emily de Chatelaine, who actually was a physicist and a mathematician. And she worked on translations until, at age 40, she died in childbirth. And then the poet, I don't think Rosalind Franklin ever met Sylvia Plath, but it was possible because they were both around Cambridge. She'd gone to Cambridge, and she might have gone to a reception when Sylvia Plath was there. And Sylvia Plath has a poem called Tulips, written in the hospital. So it just seemed to work in. I have a poet's mind, and I brought it in.
So I wanted to say, connect.
Everything connects. There are all these patterns.
Well, it's really quite nice to be able to do that. That's one of the beauties of creative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's entirely possible you are imagining them in their context.
Yes.
And all the things that were happening then
and
were important. So I think that's perfectly legitimate.
I
really like that little touch.
Yeah. No, I think it's wonderful. I mean, everybody's story has brought people to life, and I think that's what we're bringing in, the emotions and the context, the smells, the senses, all of that.
Yes, it's quite wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Ellen, and thanks to all three of you for being here tonight and bringing these women to life. I wondered whether we can come back to Carolee Waking and talk about the music we're going to hear for the end of the program. What have you chosen for us to close with and why?
Well, there are two pieces there. I think we're going to hear We Rise Again.
Yes, we're going to hear that one for sure, and we're going to try to hear the second one.
Okay, so the first one, We Rise Again, is a Rankin Family song, as many people know, but we're going to hear Sister Loon singing it, and this is a group of women singers. I think they probably coalesced around Betsy Toro, who is an amazing, multi-talented singer from the Niagara region.
Okay.
And this is just a particularly beautiful rendition. And I think that one of the things about Brought to Light is that these women are rising again in our imaginations.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're going to hear that wonderful sort of anthem, We Rise Again, done by Sister Loon, for sure. And then we might get to hear another one. So why don't you tell us about that one? It's by the Medieval Babes, whose name I love, and it's called Umlahi. What do you know about that one?
Well, that was written by one of the singers in the group, and she wrote it in her own language, so it has words, but I don't know what they mean.
Her own language being one she made up.
She made it up, and she called it after herself. And so it's lovely, and it has vocalization, but the words, the meaning of the words is unknown to us.
The meaning of the words is up to the listener, I guess.
I guess it is. Anyway, more women.
More women to close with tonight. So wonderful choices, I think. That'll be great fun. So thank you all three again, Carolee Waking, Ellen S. Jaffe, and Jean Ryan standing in for Barbara Ribella. Thank you for being here.
And we hope that Barbara's feeling better.
Yes, we do. And we also want to thank Bernadette, who's not only the host of Art Waves, but the editor of this book.
Here.
Without Bernadette, we wouldn't have had this wonderful book, and feel these women rising again.
Aw, well, thank you so much, Ellen.
And Seraphim Editions.
Yes, very much. Our publisher,
Maureen White.
Maureen White Seraphim Editions is
really the reason for the season here. That's fantastic. All right. Well, thank you all for being here, and thank you out there for listening. And again, a happy Chinese New Year to you. And I hope that you can join me again next week. And until then, this is Bernadette Rule, wishing you a good night on the shores of Lake Ontario. When the waves roll.
Umlahi in some night.